Please be seated. I hadn't realized these terms had gone so quickly. Good morning. Today we do begin the October 2007 term of court. We welcome members of the bar, the public, to our court's proceedings. Our first order of business will be two motions for admission, and we'll first recognize Commander LeBlanc for a motion. Your motion's granted as well.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Commander Paul C. LeBlanc. I move the admission of Colonel Louis J. Puglio, member of the State Bar of New York. I've examined his credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I'm satisfied he possesses the qualifications for membership in the bar of this court.
Very good. Your motion's granted. And before the oath is administered, we will now recognize John Sparks for a motion.
Judges of the court, and it pleases the court, it is my honor and privilege to move the admission of one Adam Michael Smith of the bar of the state of Maryland. I also have examined his credentials on file with the clerk, and I am satisfied that he possesses the qualification for membership to the bar as well.
Your motion is granted. Thank you. And the clerk will now administer the oath of admission to the bar to our two newest members. Congratulations. You now join the more than 33,000 other attorneys who have become members of our bar, providing vital legal services to the men and women of our armed forces. Colonel Puglio, welcome to the bar and to your new position. Congratulations. Judge Baker, would you care to offer any remarks at this time?
I would, if you don't mind. I know folks are anxious to get to our oral argument, but I had the pleasure of working with Adam Smith the past year. He was a part of my chambers team. And I'll note at the outset that his daughter, Izzy, has the same flair for argument and expression as does Adam. I'd also like to question whether John Sparks, in fact, read Adam's credentials on file with the clerk, because when I first got his credentials as part of his application, I actually went through, I thought his resume and stuff was stapled to somebody else's and then to somebody else's, because the list of publications was so long and the list of experience, and I thought I was dealing with three or four people. And I figured out finally that there was no staple there. Rather than review for you his credentials on file with the clerk, which would take most of today, I will tell you a personal story. I made the mistake of mentioning to Adam that my two young children liked postcards. And so when Adam went on a trip recently after finishing his clerkship, my children did not receive a single postcard. They received 25 postcards each. It was like in the movie Play It Again, Sam, where the guy calls from every payphone in each corner indicating where he is now in case you need him. That's the kind of person Adam is. I'm fortunate to have him as a friend for the rest of my life, as are my kids. So welcome.
Thank you, Judge Baker. On behalf of all the judges on the court, we welcome both of our new members. And Adam, welcome back to the court, and we wish you the very best. The court now calls our first case of the term, Donato against the United States. This is a writ appeal, and we shall hear first from counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Judge, members of the court. If defense counsel chooses to advise his client, he must do so accurately, especially on matters of particular concern to his client, such as the deportation consequences of his plea. This case is about the fundamental right to counsel and the viability of quorum nobis relief in the military justice system. Now, because this case comes to the court after final judgment and after direct appellate review is over, the court must face the threshold question of whether or not it has jurisdiction to entertain this writ appeal. We say the answer is yes for three reasons. The Frischultz, United States v. Frischultz line of cases, starting in 1966, Clinton v. Goldsmith, and congressional ratification. Starting with Frischultz. The issue that we're addressing right now was faced by this court in 1966 squarely, and and this court found that it had jurisdiction beyond final judgment, beyond Article 76 final judgment. A year later, in Gale v. United States, this court described its holding it for Schultz and said, for Schultz, unequivocally, I quote, unequivocally declared our jurisdiction extended beyond the ordinary appellate review of courts martial. In 1969 and again in 1975, the United States Supreme Court cited the holding for Schultz with approval. And this court reaffirmed its holding for Schultz in Del Prado v. United States in 1974. So to go from unequivocally having jurisdiction to no jurisdiction at all, as the government would have this court believe, would be a massive sea change in this court's, jurisprudence.
Counsel. Cases like Del Prado dealt with a situation in which the proceeding was void ab initio for lack of jurisdiction. What we have here is a garden variety ineffective assistance of counsel case. Isn't that distinguishable?
That's factually distinguishable. When you look back at the Fischel's case, that was not a case that was void ab initio. So the origin of this line of cases is distinct from that. I recognize in that case, if we started with that case, it might not be as powerful a line of cases, but we did start with Fischel's. And the line includes some cases that have pure initial jurisdictional defects, like the failure to elect military judge alone for a general court martial. But the original line, I believe, is a much broader holding than in Del Prado.
Is it your position that quorum nobis is available forever, or at least as long as the accused is alive, regardless of lapse of time?
It has no limit. That's United States versus Morgan, the Supreme Court case. And while that may be a troubling concept to have indefinite review, and it may seem to cut against, it does cut against the rule of finality. And that's an important rule and must be respected. But it also must have an exception to due justice. And that's what the elements of quorum nobis allow for. It has very tough standards. It's a high hurdle we have to clear to ask this court to grant extraordinary relief. But that exception, essentially, to the finality rule is necessary so that injustices do not get permanently embedded in our system with no means to remedy them.
Is quorum nobis available in an Article III district court?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So it's available in both places at the same time?
That's a good question. If this court has jurisdiction, as we believe it does, then we would have to exhaust remedies here. That's annoyed the Bond and Schlesinger v. Councilman. If we went to district court first and tried a quorum nobis petition, we imagine the government would argue we failed to exhaust, as it did in Fischel's, in fact. Fischel's is very interesting in that respect. Captain Fischel's, went to the district court first. The government
I'm asking, what is your position at this point? Would you have jurisdiction to, would you be able to seek quorum nobis in an Article III court over there today?
I don't believe so, Ron.
Are you conceding that point today?
Well, we can, but not today, because we haven't exhausted the avenue in the military justice system. That's what I'm trying to say, Your Honor.
So if we said today we don't have jurisdiction, you could then go to the district court, correct?
There or perhaps take the issue up to the Supreme Court, but if this remedy were not available here, I believe we could go to the district court.
Counsel, are you familiar with the litigation in the case of the United States against New? That's the case in which this court held that the responsibility for determining the lawfulness of an order rests with a military judge and not with a panel. Are you familiar with the collateral litigation in that case?
The name isn't jogging the memory.
Okay, well, that's a case in which the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia held that there is jurisdiction under Section 1331 of Title 28 when a service member is not in custody.
Right.
Are you familiar with Opperman?
Yes, sir.
And I believe in Opperman, Judge Emmett Sullivan cited New as a basis for exercising jurisdiction in that case when the individual was not in custody. Why would not a 1331 suit lie at this time and the District Court of the District of Columbia.
I believe because we haven't exhausted remedies within the military justice system, and under Noy v. Bond, if we fail to do that, the District Court could kick us out of court.
I'm not aware in either Opperman or specifically in New that there was a collateral attack in our court. They went directly after having exhausted their direct remedies in our court to the District Court in the District of Columbia.
I know in Opperman he sought a grant for petition for grant of review, and that was denied.
Right, but in New,
upward mobility to the Supreme Court. So in that sense, it is distinct from this case.
And are you aware of any district court that has held that exhaustion of collateral remedies in our court is necessary after Article 76 finality?
I believe that's for Schultz. I don't know the district court site, but that from that case, the government argued that the member failed to exhaust the collateral remedy available in the military justice system, and then he went to the military justice system, and the government argued that this court didn't have jurisdiction because of the final judgment rule. So starting from the original case.
Anything since then? I mean, there have been many, many cases in which the district courts have exercised jurisdiction over military justice cases, not simply in habeas matters.
I can't think of a case, and I don't think it's in a brief, to that effect on it.
Okay. Well, is there any reason why this court shouldn't dismiss without prejudice to refile, and if it does turn out that a district court won't take the case? That is, right now, it would appear, based upon New, that there's an available remedy in the district court for the District of Columbia, and based on Opperman. Now, if it turns out that they decline and they say you need to go back to the military courts, we would still be available. But at this stage, looking at the procedural situation, why shouldn't we do that?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, given that we've been on this line of questioning long enough, I have thought of another idea.
Okay. I could keep asking questions. You'd get a few more.
I appreciate the lifeline. I think the answer lies in Loving, the 2005 decision, where this court recognized that the scope of review in a case like Opperman may not be as broad as it needs to be. And if you don't have a first crack at the issue in the military court, the second crack at it in the district court might not be as broad and as full as it needs to be. So I think this court recognized that there was uncertainty as to the scope of review, collateral review in the 1331 case, and I think that was the reason the court took jurisdiction over the Loving matter. One of the reasons, there were others, but that factored in the Loving decision. I'd also say Congress confided primary responsibility for military justice matters in the military justice court system, so that militates in favor of keeping it here.
Doesn't Schlesinger against Councilman stand for the proposition that no matter how much confidence Congress has vested in this court, that Article III review remains available? Isn't that one of the fundamental principles of Schlesinger against Councilman?
Yes, I believe that.
And so why shouldn't that apply? Why shouldn't that apply here? That is, Article 670 finality has been reached. If he was in confinement, he could get habeas review. Why shouldn't he get quorum nobis review in the Article 3 courts?
I believe he could, but I think it would be under the full and fair review standard, which is not as generous as the standard that he would receive if this court were to take jurisdiction of it. I think I somewhat said that already. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I think that's my best response.
Thank you.
At the moment.
Under the All Writs Act, we can issue writs, prerogative writs, in aid of our jurisdiction. Under Goldsmith, if we issued this writ, how is this in aid of our jurisdiction? Other than the point the government makes in the sense of exercising a general superintendency over military justice, which Goldsmith says we don't have.
Yes, Your Honor. We this court has the jurisdiction to review the findings and sentences of courts martial, and as we believe, the judgments, the final judgments of the lower court and this court.
Mm-hmm. And direct review has been exhausted.
Correct.
Yeah.
And in Goldsmith was a case where it was post-final judgment. And it obviously distinguishable because it didn't address the underlying merits of the case or the finding and sentence of the court martial. And I think Goldsmith actually has language in it that although I can see where you make go with it.
Well, and Goldsmith addressed a collateral consequence of conviction, as does this case.
Correct. And because it was a, well, I disagree on a...
dropping from the roles in Goldsmith was collateral consequence.
Right. He was attacking that collateral consequence. We're not attacking the collateral consequence. We're attacking the underlying conviction. In our view, it's invalid because it was the result of ineffective assistance of counsel.
You're attacking the underlying conviction only because of the collateral consequence.
That brought it to our attention, Your Honor, but it doesn't change the fact that we have a... We believe
you're questioning the plea, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Providence of the
plea.
Johnson v. Zerbst, Hill v. Lockhart claim.
Would your case be any different, your jurisdictional argument be different at all in nuance if this court had heard the case? That's correct. It's a flat question.
What part of our case be different?
Well, did your jurisdictional argument.
We may be pre-final judgment if
you were pre, but if there's no spin to this question, so you don't have to try and figure. I'm truly interested in whether you have a view on this one way or the other, which is you indicated, and I think fairly so, that you're at a point of final judgment here. But back when. Your client did not take appeal to this court, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would it make any difference now in terms of how you shape the jurisdictional argument if your client had?
If he had, so.
Remember, we're shaping the law not just for this case, but for other cases as well.
I'm having difficulty placing where I would be in the system. Would I be post a CCA decision that affirmed the conviction and pre-petition for grant of review?
No. You 7 years ago, your client then appeals to this court. This appeal, let's say, grants his petition, hears the case, and rules against him on whatever. Now, 7 years later, you're back up here arguing IAC.
That would be a problem if the issue were raised below, because quorum nobis is not available to seek reconsideration. One of the prongs of quorum nobis relief would be...
And we didn't hear the IAC issue. We heard something else. You're saying facts here where the IAC, your alleged IAC, is not recognized until 7 years later.
I believe we would still be able to come to this court, especially for a pre-final judgment, if we could meet the elements of quorum nobis, one of which is valid reasons for not seeking relief before. So if we just simply tried to keep this court's jurisdiction open by keeping that issue in our back pocket while we knew we had it all along, that would be improper. We couldn't do that. The key to quorum nobis is that the petitioner could not have discovered the issue earlier. If he had, that's a fatal blow to quorum nobis relief.
If we granted your petition, what's to keep every garden variety IAC case that wasn't raised below for whatever reason from coming in here on a prerogative writ?
Counsel's obligation to not bring frivolous claims. I keep coming back to Frischholz with you, Your Honor. I think it hasn't opened the floodgates since then. I don't think if the court were to continue the Frischholz line, the floodgates would be any different. The flow would be the same. So I don't anticipate that this court would get swamped with those sort of petitions.
Well, Frischholz was actually spent much of the opinion concerned with arguing with the government's contention that this court didn't have any jurisdiction under the All Writs Act, right, to hear a case at all, and taking issue at that point. Am I right so far?
The government is.
That's what the government did in Frischholz, and the Frischholz opinion spent a lot of time saying why that was incorrect,
yes,
right, and saying that, no, this court can take cases under the All Writs Act, right?
That's right.
And then it cited the Busick case, right?
I believe believe so.
And it inserted the word normally in front of what the Supreme Court actually said, which is when they were talking about Article 53, which was the precursor to Article 76, they said that it marked, I want to make sure that I have it right, that it marked the terminal point for proceedings within the court-martial system. I mean, that's what Cusick said, didn't it?
Yes.
And then this court in Frischholz inserted the word normally, or the normal, in front of terminal point, didn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, and Frischholz was also decided at a time when this court's perception of its own power and authority was much more expansive than the Supreme Court has since recognized it to be, wasn't it?
I don't know. I would quarrel with that if the basis for that argument is Goldsmith's. If it's something else, I'm not sure what Your Honor is referring to.
Well, I mean, Goldsmith, this court's opinion in Goldsmith, cited to many lower court opinions by this court talking about our need and responsibility and authority to basically look after anything and everything within the military justice system, didn't it? This court's opinion, Goldsmith.
Yes.
And that proposition was rejected by the Supreme Court, wasn't it?
Correct.
And just one more question. If Article 70, do you doubt that if your client had come upon these facts within 2 years after his conviction was final, that he would have had the right to bring a motion or a petition for a new trial?
If he discovered this within the 2 years, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So what does Article 76 mean if it doesn't mean that once that two-year period is over and he doesn't bring a petition for a new trial, that this court has no more ability to look at the proceedings?
I don't believe that's what Article 76 does say. I think Article 76, and I would view it through at least the lens of Schlesinger initially, where the court said Article 76, I think it uses the word merely or only, defines when direct review is over and when a judgment must have res judicata effect. And then the next, I think, sentence in Schlesinger says, but it does not bar collateral review of void judgments in a court of jurisdiction.
And Schlesinger is concerned entirely with the jurisdiction of Article III courts and the power and ability of Article III courts to look at cases from the military justice system on collateral review, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think it's primarily, Your Honor, but I think it also also looked at comedy and exhaustion.
And didn't it review the long history of Article III courts' collateral review of court-martial proceedings?
Yes.
And then didn't it say that since you have not even sought a petition for a new trial, go back to the military justice system and try that first?
Yes.
And then if that doesn't work, you can come back to us on habeas.
I believe so.
It didn't say try and get a new trial and then go and seek a habeas petition in the military justice system, did it?
I think that's, it's escaping me, but there was a new trial petition tolling case where the district court sent the case back to the military for failure to avail itself of a viable remedy. But you're right, I don't believe that existed in Schlesinger.
You were going to make 3 points when you started. Did you make your 3 points?
I hope so. I see that I'm down to 5 minutes.
I'd like to hear the congressional point.
I'm sorry, sir?
You were going to say you had something on Clinton v. Goldsmith, yes. And you had something on congressional ratification, in your words. Have you made all those points, or did you get sidetracked on case law there?
I was being sidetracked. Now.
You don't have to concede that it was a sidetrack.
But
what were the two other arguments, if you don't mind saying?
Yes, Your Honor. What I wanted to do is point out a passage in Goldsmith. We believe Goldsmith actually is squarely on our side in this case and not. It doesn't give the effect that the government would have it give. and that is on page 536, where it recognized a slightly different factual situation than what Goldsmith actually was, and it said, I quote, it would presumably be an entirely different matter if a military authority attempted to alter a judgment by revising a court-martial finding and sentence to increase the punishment contrary to the specific provisions of UCMJ, and certainly would be a different matter when such a judgment had been affirmed by an appellate court.
Isn't that Del Prado? Isn't that another case where you've got a blatant, are you claiming that deportation, assuming arguendo it happened, is punishment? Increases the punishment in the sense of the code?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the relevance of that passage?
We believe that given that this case, this scenario slightly alters Goldsmith's fact pattern in a final judgment, post-final judgment case, it's recognizing that this court has jurisdiction over its judgments beyond final judgment. So while it's tailored, the scenario is tailored to a Goldsmith fact pattern and one that's more analogous to Del Prado, I think it stands for the proposition that this court does have jurisdiction beyond final judgments. It didn't lay out every scenario, of course, Your Honor, but it recognized it. And that's where we see Fischholz coexisting peacefully with Goldsmith and not in tension with Goldsmith. I hope that answers, at least that's my answer. The final point is congressional ratification. We believe Congress must be deemed to have ratified this court's jurisdiction beyond final judgment because it sat by and seen Fischholz, it's seen Goldsmith, it's seen all these cases, and it hasn't amended Article 76 one time in a substantive way that would restrict this court's subject matter jurisdiction. That's a congressional ratification argument.
Counsel, as I read the government's brief, their argument is that your client doesn't have a problem because under the government's reading of immigration law, he can't be deported. Is that your understanding of the government's brief?
I understand that's what the government is arguing, but...
Okay, they've argued that. Why shouldn't we take them at their word, deny the petition without prejudice to coming back if that's not in fact the case, and have you all go back to the immigration proceedings and say, here's what the government says. My client can't be deported. If the government's accurate, then there's no need for us to exercise jurisdiction in this case, is there?
I have a few responses, Your Honor. First, I don't think we can take the government at its word because the government is taking inconsistent positions simultaneously on this point and has not withdrawn its charge out of Minnesota in the deportation court.
Well, we're here. If it turns out that the government takes a different position that place, you can come back here.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor, because that was my fallback position, is if the court finds that it needs to have a deportation order in hand before it can entertain this case, it'd be unfortunate because the marshals would probably...
That wasn't my question. My question is the United States has represented in this court, a representative of the United States has represented to us that your client can't be deported. I'm not suggesting that we need to have an order. If the Department of Justice or some other authority would say that that's not the case, then we'd be in a different posture. But right now, a lawyer of the United States has represented that in this court.
Another response I have to that is during the pendency of this case, while the government made that argument that he cannot be deported as with an aggravated felony charge, they brought another charge. And they allege that the special court-martial conviction is yet another basis for deportation. It's not an automatic basis, unlike the aggravated felony. So the fear, the risk is less, but it's still a severe risk, and it's still, when measured against the advice that was given by my client's trial defense counsel, there's a wide gap between the two, and that's where we cited cases like...
Leaving aside the question of whether he's going to be deported or what's going to happen, and leaving aside the government's representations is the exact state of immigration law. The counsel bargained this thing down to a special. He got 3 months confinement. Immigration law, which I once practiced, is a matter of Byzantine complexity. Does this really rise to IAC under Strickland, given what he did for his client?
Yes.
How?
What was left after that quote-unquote negotiated plea was an aggravated felony, now I understand the court is asking me to assume that that's not in the picture. But there's also...
Well, I'm not asking you to assume that.
Okay. The court hasn't asked you anything. You've had questions, but I don't know what...
Then I would say,
I'm saying regardless of whether that's true or not, given what he did for his client, is this really IAC under Strickland?
Absolutely. What he left on the table posed a severe risk of deportation. I would say it's virtually automatic if the aggravated felony stays on the table, and we think a plain reading of that statute is... I recognize the whole Title 8 is big and complicated, but the provision that says an offense involving fraud or deceit where the loss to the victim is over $10,000 is plain and simple, and it's a fairly well-recognized proposition from 5 minutes of research in the Board of Immigration Appeals that the courts can look at the entire record and see if the elements are met, not just at the charge sheet, not just at the indictment, not just at the plea colloquy, the whole record. And the whole record here, it's clear that he faces a grave risk of automatic deportation, Your Honor. And there's also the discretionary charge that is, while not as radioactive as aggravated felonies, poses a grave risk as well. So in the United States versus Cotto and Kwan recognize that the delta between where a counsel says you face some risk of deportation and the risk is actually much higher is sufficient. That gap is sufficient for ineffective assistance of counsel because it's unreasonable. If you don't know what you're talking about, you can't speak to your client and advise them improperly. If you have to get an expert, you can go get an expert. We believe the advice given was plain, objectively unreasonable.
Counsel, you may be a little misled there by our clock this morning. It's showing green, but your time is up, and you'll have an opportunity for a rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Paul Bundy, and I represent the United States in this matter. This case presents this court with the opportunity to build upon the foundation laid in Loving v. United States and further clarify the boundaries of the military appellate court's jurisdiction in extraordinary writ cases like this one. First of all, as Judge Stuckey pointed out, the All Writs Act only confers the power to act in aid of the court's already existing jurisdiction. And in this case, this court's jurisdiction ended when the case became final on May 30th of 2000, when the appellant was discharged from the service with a bad conduct discharge. Loving recognized the limits and the finality and the interplay between Article 71 and Article 76.
Is it the government's view that the appellant could not seek, but there would be jurisdiction that achieve quorum nobis in Article 3 District Court?
In certain circumstances, if there
is. In this circumstance. If we rule that we do not have jurisdiction, is the government prepared to concede at this time that there is jurisdiction across the street? Or is it the government having it both ways, saying you lose here and you lose there too?
My understanding would be that yes, they would have jurisdiction to bring a written in Article 3 court.
Is that the government's position, or is that your oral argument position based on duress?
That is my understanding. That is this counsel's understanding of the law.
But what is the government's position? In all fairness to the appellant and to us, since we have one of the issues is. Is there an appropriate other venue? Is there an appropriate other venue or not, according to the government?
First of all, the underlying issue of whether he was even deportable has not yet been decided by the immigration courts.
But let's say, put that aside, let's say he's attacking the providence of his plea on some other grounds, but it's the same facts, but instead of the deportation being the issue, it's something else.
And just to be clear, I think Judge Baker isn't asking you to concede that he's entitled to a writ of habeas.
I'm asking the jurisdictional question, not the bottom line.
Yes, I think jurisdictionally, absolutely, there would be a remedy in the three courts because...
If appropriate, is it?
And if it was otherwise appropriate, he's exhausted his remedy.
And that's the government's view here today, not just, in fairness to you, what your gut response.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, are you familiar with the litigation involving a naval member by the name of Norbert McLean?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not. Yeah.
Oh, Okay, well, McLean came to our court, been here a variety of times, and been to a number of other courts seeking writs of quorum nobis, seeking back pay in the court of claims, etc. And he sought a writ of quorum nobis in district court in California, and that court held that it didn't have jurisdiction. Now, what if that happens here? If, for whatever reason, he goes to this individual goes to a district court where he's located, and that district court holds that that's the case, or the D.C. Circuit decides that maybe they didn't get it right in New, and there is no jurisdiction. Is he in a position where he can't get quorum nobis anywhere?
Well, speculating on what might happen, the other avenue of relief that's still available to this petitioner in this case is, number one, to fight the issue in the immigration courts. It may well still be found that he is not deportable. That issue has not yet been decided. And after that court enters its judgment, then appeal the order of the immigration court up through the Article III courts. And
are you suggesting that he should contest the providency of his guilty plea in the immigration court?
Not necessarily in the immigration court, but on appeal of that deportation order. There are several cases cited in both of our briefs discussing immigration where United States v. Kwan is one example where an Article III appellate court has taken up a quorum nobis petition, and for example in Kwan they directed the district court to enter a sentence of less than a year to protect an appellant from deportation based upon ineffective assistance of counsel and erroneous advice.
So in your view, Kwan was an immigration case that was transformed into a quorum nobis case, and that's what would happen here?
Yes, after the immigration deportation order, Kwan appealed up. Whether it was a quorum nobis or a regular appeal, I'm not sure, I'd have to double check. But he did have that avenue of relief available to him in the Article III courts, and Kwan was in fact granted relief and protected from deportation.
But Kwan didn't suggest that the preferred methodology was to try and exhaust your remedy in a deportation proceeding first, did it? I mean, in fairness, that was a hurdle that the petitioner in that case or the appellant in that case had to overcome.
Yes, Your Honor, and Kwan was also a different set of circumstances. It wasn't a military case, and I'm not sure if that ineffective assistance issue was ever litigated on direct appeal. It was a different story originally, and so like this case, the petitioner wasn't aware of the erroneous advice until Immigration and Customs Enforcement went for deportation.
What is the effect of your position in this case that this is not a deportable offense?
After the United States argued that position in its brief, we filed our brief at this court on April 9th of this year, and as is noted in the immigration papers that the appellant attached to his reply brief, 3 days later, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Division dropped the charge that specified that the special court martial serious felonies, and they substituted its place an alternate charge merely alleging that you have been convicted of two crimes involving moral turpitude not arising out of a single scheme of criminal misconduct.
So is that argument gone? The argument that you raised that it's not a deportable offense, that's no longer an argument for you?
Well, my interpretation of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement action in dropping that specific charge that I made my argument to indicates that they agreed that he was not deportable on the basis of that particular charge, and they amended the charge to substitute, in lieu of the original charge, to substitute the two crimes of moral turpitude not involved in the same scheme.
Well, how does that affect the merits of the IAC petition?
On the IAC issue, Your Honor.
Whether it was IAC or not.
Whether it was IAC or not, I think any action by this court would be, as alluded to earlier, would be entirely premature, because one very possible outcome of the immigration proceedings is that he's not deportable.
Well, isn't the appellant arguing that that he misadvised him on the aggravated felony?
Yeah.
That's part of the argument.
Right, and now they've dropped the aggravated felony, so where does that leave the IAC claim?
I think it leaves it very much up in the air, Your Honor. Part of my argument is that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case, at least under the very high burden that Strickland sets forth.
Wasn't the original argument was it was ineffective assistance of counsel because he misadvised him about whether or not this was a deportable offense, when in fact, as a petitioner argues, he was automatically deportable because it was an aggravated felony. That was the original argument, correct?
Yes, sir.
And your response was, no, the government's gotten it wrong. It's not an automatically deportable offense, right?
Yes, sir.
And the rest of the government agreed with you and withdrew that.
Yes, sir.
So now what's left is potentially deportable offenses, or what is left now?
Well, what's left now is a charge based on two crimes of moral turpitude not involving the same scheme of misconduct. It's not on the record, but when I spoke to the attorney, Mr. Louie, he said that's still based on the underlying charges at the special court martial. It's just not it's on a different theory than it's an aggravated felony and it's a larceny of over $10,000. It's just two crimes involving moral turpitude. So he's still potentially deportable and it's still based on the special court martial conviction. My argument in my original brief was addressed to the specific charges that originally was set forth. That charge is now gone, so that whole argument was narrowly tailored to the specific charge. And since that charge has been dropped and another charge substituted, that section of my brief has been sort of mooted out. The government.
Counsel, you finish with your question? You referred to your original brief. Have you filed another brief?
No, I'm sorry.
So here we have a brief filed. The defense has filed, it was the defense filed a piece of paper referring to the immigration proceedings. And the record before us is we have nothing from the government. Is that correct? We don't have any statement from the government as to, in filed with this court, as to whether that document is or is not accurate. We have no statement from the government filed with this court as to how that document changed, if at all, the government's legal position. Today you're offering us a new legal position, not in your brief. Is that correct?
My original argument in my brief was that Mr. Ceballos, the civilian counsel at trial, was not ineffective based on the Strickland standard because of the Byzantine nature of immigration law, and that the focus of my argument was that he was not necessarily deportable.
I thought you said that he couldn't be deported under that in the brief.
And that was arguing in the context of whether he was ineffective or not. It was, the government was put in a very impossible decision where on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we have to defend the actions of the attorney below.
I understand your factual situation. Here's what your brief says on page 11. Appellant can therefore not be deported based upon the commission of a theft offense, since the sentence actually judged, approved, and executed in his case 3 months far below the 3 years. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. That was based only on that narrow code provision in the U.S. Code where a theft offense, just a theft offense without anything more, requires a year of confinement that should be imposed. So he couldn't be deported just because he was convicted of a theft offense. Then there's yet another provision of the code that talks about, is there more than $10,000 of loss involved in a case involving fraud or deceit? And I went into some length on for me, at least, confusing, as Judge Stuckey pointed out, Byzantine nature of whether a charge involves fraud or deceit.
Well, as I read the brief on page 12, it then says, and therefore do not constitute aggravated felonies for deportation purposes. Was that not your argument that he couldn't be deported under the charge that was then brought against him? Was that the argument you made to our court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you never filed anything to change that argument. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Going back to Kwan, unless I'm reading Kwan incorrectly, it looks to me like that's a Coram Novus case from the beginning, not an immigration appeal. Is that accurate?
I don't dispute that at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll have to go back and read it. The, if I could go back to the Supreme Court cases, Dusick and Schlesinger v. Councilman, when those cases talked about exceptions to Article 76 for jurisdiction, they were talking about Article 3 court's ability to entertain writs of habeas corpus and other writs. And the court recognized that Article 76 could not be taken absolutely literally, because to do so would be a violation of the suspension clause, suspending a writ of habeas corpus. And so the court, the Supreme Court, recognized a narrow exception to finality to entertain cases where the underlying judgment was void ab initio because of jurisdictional or other such fundamental errors. And what the court recognized there was that there's only an exception to finality when the error is so fundamental that it affects the underlying, whether it's jurisdiction where the court was just void at the outset, or an equally fundamental error that affected the validity of the proceedings.
Is it a fundamental error to act without counsel in the abstract? Would you, so if you were court-martialed and you were not represented by counsel, you wouldn't view that as a fundamental error? I'm saying literally there is no counsel there.
That could be seen as a fundamental error, yes, Your Honor. Jurisdiction is not the only fundamental error in this particular
case. Would that be a fundamental error? There you are, you're court-martialed and you're not represented by counsel.
Well, since
you're there by your, there you are, Lance Corporal Baker, and there's no counsel. Is that fundamental?
I'd have to research the law. That's not the question presented here, so I haven't looked at that issue, Your Honor. At least as regards to this case, the attorney making an error in advising on collateral consequences is not a fundamental error.
But that's not the issue. The issue is whether he received effective assistance of counsel ultimately, which goes to whether he received his constitutional right to be represented by counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
It has nothing to do with deportation. The whether it was the IAC piece has something to do with deportation, but let's imagine that it's a claim of innocence on a rape charge and the counsel had DNA that would exonerate him and never did anything with it. So the deportation is a little bit of a red herring on the jurisdictional issue. Would that be a fundamental right issue if the defense counsel had DNA evidence that exonerated, the government produces it, Brady, here you go, defense counsel never does anything with it?
In that case, I would say that the error then by the counsel is of constitutional dimension, because the final part of the test for ineffective assistance of counsel is whether the outcome would have been different.
Okay, and in that case then, would there be a fundamental issue?
Because in that case, where the defense attorney had exculpatory DNA evidence and did nothing with it, that would certainly be an error of constitutional dimension and could be viewed as fundamental in nature.
Now, did Dusick or Schlesinger tell us anything beyond that once you find that fundamental error that an Article III court has collateral jurisdiction over it?
As long as the if the military court's direct review is complete, Miller tells us that the Article III courts should wait until completion of direct review and exhaust their remedies in the military court. But Schlesinger v. Councilman would both say that yes, Article III courts would have jurisdiction and retain on a fundamental error.
What's the difference? Did you have a follow-up?
Well, all I'm asking, does that help us answer our question about whether we have jurisdiction in those same circumstances?
I think where this the exception, the Supreme Court crafted a very narrow exception based on the suspension clause that, with regard to jurisdiction, in all three Supreme Court cases, or the two important ones, Dusick and Councilman, that directly addressed it, both dealt with the underlying jurisdiction of the court martial to even try that service member in the first place, whether under the service connection test.
But I think the question goes to all that line of argument. Does that go to our jurisdiction, or does that go to an Article III jurisdiction, or both?
those cases actually went to the jurisdiction in Article III court to decide.
I know, but is the analysis applicable here or not?
I would say it is if that on a fundamental issue that is equivalent, that makes the underlying judgment void, then the government would agree that this court has jurisdiction in those narrow circumstances.
And how do you square that with Article 76? Because, I mean, that's what we run up against is Article 76.
Yes, Your Honor. And what there was a comment in Clinton v. Goldsmith that questioned whether even if this court had jurisdiction, whether an extraordinary writ is appropriate, because an extraordinary writ is a last chance when no other remedy is available. And so only in the narrow circumstance where an exception to the finality of Article 76 is constitutionally required, and that was in the context of a habeas writ, where they were talking about that fundamental issue of jurisdiction. And in this case, there are other remedies, and in Clinton v. Goldsmith, they talked about administrative as well as judicial remedies, and here the petitioner, appellant, has remedies available to him. He can still challenge the action of the Immigration Customs Fuzzle and argue that he is not deportable. And he may very well be found.
And you've also stated that he could seek quorum nobis in Article III District Court.
Yes, Your Honor. So he has other avenues of relief, and that brings into question whether it's necessary and appropriate for this court to act in the first place. Because there are other avenues of relief, bringing a writ here is not the last chance available to him.
How do you answer the appellant's Frischholz argument that says Frischholz is basically dispositive, that it's not limited to fundamental questions of jurisdiction, void, avoidable, ab initio?
Frischholz starts off by looking at the Supreme Court cases and straightforwardly acknowledging that this court has jurisdiction to entertain extraordinary writs where questions of jurisdiction are involved. So did the underlying court-martial even have personal jurisdiction over the accused in the first place?
Wasn't the issue in Frischholz the fundamental question, the applicability of the statute to this court?
And that was an issue raised by the government in Frischholz, was whether this court was even a court contemplated by the
By the All-Writs Act, right.
And of course it was. That issue was well settled.
Mm-hmm.
What Frischholz did was, after acknowledging that the only very narrow exception to Article 76 finality was fundamental issues of jurisdiction that rendered the judgment void, then went on to discuss that the court had powers protective of Article 67 and that this court was a last military court of resort to protect the service members' constitutional rights. And that language sort of squeezed the envelope of jurisdiction and started trending in, that started the trend towards the territory of just the general supervisory power, but ultimately the Supreme Court said, no, that does not exist, and we can't use that.
Was it your contention that Frischholz was overruled, at least in part, sub silentio by Goldsmith?
At least for the proposition that Frischholz stands for the idea that the court can exercise jurisdiction in an extraordinary writ case to protect other powers after finality. There are also a couple of cases, I did not cite them in my brief, but one of them was cited in Lovell v. United States, United States v. Krause, 1979 case, and there was another case in 1972, Allen, where this court very straightforwardly ruled, hey, the case is final, we have no jurisdiction. Article 76 says finality, and that's what it means. Those cases have sort of disappeared, very rarely cited. In fact, Krause was cited in Lovell for a proposition other than the main holding in the case. And that indefinite border of where the jurisdiction lies, which this case presents the court for an opportunity to further define, is reflected in the Navy cases cited in the defense's reply brief, such as Fisher and Thompson, where Fisher just very briefly touched on jurisdiction and cited the Frischholz argument that this is a court created by Congress, therefore the All-Writs Act applied, and they said, therefore we would have writ jurisdiction without anything further. Thompson was a case that was final, and reviewed.
was complete, and then they came back and said, oh, wait, maybe he was had sanity issues, and the court ordered his bad conduct discharge reversed, and even after finality, and said, do a 706 board. That was not in the government's position, a fundamental issue that voided the judgment below. There was full opportunity to address sanity issues during the trial and afterwards, and it was never brought up until a couple of years later. And so these cases just demonstrate where, absent those firm boundaries, and I understand the question of whether an issue truly is fundamental and the equivalent of a jurisdictional problem that renders the judgment void, where do those boundaries exactly lie? It's hard to make a rule that says that this is it and nothing else, but at least on a case-by-case basis, the court can lay out the broad outlines and recognize that the exception to finality is extremely narrow and keep it narrow, because otherwise the door just keeps getting open wider and wider.
Counsel, what case, if any, stands for the proposition that the Article III courts aren't available to review ineffective assistance, constitutional ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
That they are not available?
Right. I understood your argument to be that Article 76 is only means that the only thing the Article III courts can review are something called fundamental claims, whatever those might be. My reading of the repeated exercise of jurisdiction by the Article III courts following Schlesinger, Gusick, Burns against Wilson, et cetera, have all been that they have not hesitated to review any constitutional claim before those courts in a habeas proceeding and sometimes in quorum nobis or 1331. Certainly in the new case, there didn't appear to be any hesitancy upon the D.C. Circuit to take a full look with a standard of deference about everything that this court did in that case. So what is this fundamental versus constitutional concept that we're talking about here?
That hasn't been very clearly defined in any of the cases, Your Honor. Where it has come up was on issues of jurisdiction, such as De Prado, and there was no written request for military judge alone trial, and then in Councilman, in some of the cases that all spun around the pre-salarial service connection test. But that was the underlying jurisdiction. The Supreme Court never squarely addressed a case that involved something else.
Well, doesn't Augenblick tell us something about that, where the Supreme Court said the Court of Federal Claims, had no jurisdiction to review on collateral review routine errors made in court-martial cases? They can review constitutional errors.
And that, I'm not familiar with that particular case, Your Honor, but that quotation recalls something from Schlesinger v. Councilman, where they said it has to be a fundamental issue and that a judgment is not rendered void merely by error. And whether fundamental is equivalent to a constitutional error or not has not been fully explored or defined. However, in this particular case, whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel, that four-part test is, in this case, it's impossible for this court to know because the hearing in the immigration court has not happened yet. If he's not deportable, where was the error of constitutional dimension?
If the United States is taking the position that he is deportable, why isn't that sufficient at this point to be considered, whether it be by our court or an Article III court, as to the advice that he had? How can the United States take the position that this individual is deportable and then say, by the way, we have to actually wait until he's deported until we review the court-martial conviction?
My understanding is that there's been no hearing in the immigration court yet saying that he is, in fact, deportable. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has charged him with being deportable, but my understanding is that no decision has been made in that regard yet.
So that the charge is not the position of the United States, it's the position of some official who doesn't exercise the authority of the United States?
Well, the United States is certainly taking that position that he is potentially deportable, just like whenever they charge anybody with a crime, the United States is taking the position that the person is guilty of the crime, or at least there's probable cause to believe. But it may still turn out that the person is found not guilty or found not deportable. If this court acts and sought by petitioner, this court is preventing a hearing in deciding immigration issues. And that is a matter left under Congress's scheme to the immigration courts. There are many cases where, for example, the Supreme Court had this wait for exhaustion in the military courts, and the same theory should apply here. This court should wait for the exhaustion of remedies through the immigration process, because a very real possibility is that the immigration court will ultimately find that he is not deportable.
But would you agree that it's the position of the United States in the immigration proceedings that he is deportable?
Yes, sir. But
and we can't have two United States. I mean, for purposes of our consideration, you're bound by what they're doing.
Yes, sir.
Because they started first, right?
Yes. And we recognize that, but once again, an ultimate conclusion of that proceeding in the immigration court is an immigration judge saying, based on this evidence, the government asserts that he's deportable. The immigration judge, could very well find he is not deportable. And if that's the case, then civilian counsel up to trial 8 years ago did not make any error of constitutional dimension. I'm down to my last minute, so I will briefly conclude. This case became final in May of 2000 when the petitioner was discharged following a full and fair opportunity for completion of appellate review. He does not now challenge the jurisdiction of the military courts to try him, nor does he assert some other equally fundamental defect. Erroneous advice by an attorney on a collateral consequence does not render his guilty plea involuntary, nor change the fact that he is guilty of the offenses to which he pled guilty in the court below. The evidence in the record on that matter is overwhelming. Even assuming jurisdiction, because the immigration courts have not yet decided whether, made a final determination as to whether petitioner is deportable, any action by this court will be premature. In any event, using the Strickland standard, even if Mr. Ceballos gave erroneous advice, it was not an error so serious that the petitioner was deprived of a fair trial when he was tried on those offenses. Accordingly, the government respectfully requests that this court deny petitioner's writ appeal for lack of jurisdiction, or any alternative to deny petitioner relief because he has not shown ineffective assistance of counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not your fault.
First, I'd like to say that we disagree with what the record reflects as far as the aggravated felony charge being dropped. The only paper before the court reflects that the discretionary basis for deportation was an add charge, not a substitution, no droppage of the aggravated felony. And counsel represented his understanding from outside the record conversations. I'd say mine contradict that. My understanding is it has not been dropped. And
what's before this court? Is that what page and where is it found and so on?
It's attached to our reply brief, and it's the add charge document, which seeks to add the discretionary basis for deportation, and it's described in two places as an additional charge. I made an inquiry after I got this document to ascertain whether it was an add or what it was, and my understanding is it's purely an add.
Counsel, while we're very interested in the representations of counsel, it's not appropriate for counsel to testify for either party before this court. Has there been any filing by either party to supplement the record since the filing of the defense, the appellant's reply?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you a quick question? It seems to me, I'm not really sure what the government's argument is, and it doesn't seem to have anything to do with Article 76, but it seems to me that they're suggesting that any court, whether it be an Article 3 court or this court, could have jurisdiction over an otherwise final judgment, but only if the issue went to jurisdiction itself or a quote-unquote fundamental error which they could not otherwise define. Would you rather have that be the rule, or would you rather have the rule be what it appears the Supreme Court has said it is, which is that This court doesn't have jurisdiction over final judgments, but Article III courts have jurisdiction over final judgments by the military justice system, if otherwise appropriate.
I'm going to ask you to restate the question, but I might not have understood it. We would like the test to be the test that's laid out in the quorum nobis body of law, which reflects that it has to be a constitutional error or a fundamental error. And I think this court in Loving recognized what the ingredients of the quorum nobis have to be. So we'd like to see this court have jurisdiction, obviously, over the issue, and we'd like it to be a test where the error has to be of a fundamental nature or a constitutional error, and I think that's consistent with Morgan. I think that's what this court, when it looked through the history of quorum nobis case law, reflects. I'm sorry I don't have the case in front of me, but I believe it's in a footnote in Loving where it talks about what quorum nobis relief is available for.
But in the Loving opinion, this court spent a great deal of time satisfying itself that the case was not actually final before it even went to the secondary question of what relief might be available to the petitioner. And if finality doesn't have some significance under Article 76 and Article 71, why do you suppose they did that? Because it seems to me that the test you would like us to apply is we can ignore the finality dictates of Article 76 so long as someone otherwise meets the requirements for writ of quorum nobis.
My reading of Loving, and I think we can only carry it so far in this case because of what you said, Hunter, it is a pre-judgment, pre-final judgment case, and most of this discussion that we're citing here doesn't really go to the decision in Loving, so it can only rest it on so much. But what is critical, I think, is that Loving reached beyond the Supreme Court, past the Supreme Court's affirmance of Loving's conviction, and it entertained jurisdiction after that. And that I think, is actually quite a broad interpretation of this court's jurisdiction, and it wanted to look within the statute to do that before it looked at any other means because it was such a broad reach of this court's jurisdiction. We don't quarrel with that, but I think that case is actually, in many respects, broader jurisdiction than the jurisdiction passed in court exercise here. I just want to make the point on the fundamental error that we believe exists in this case, and that is Kwan and Cotto recognize ineffective assistance of counsel in a case where the advice given is so at odds with the existing state of law, and that's the case we have here. In fairness, I don't want to. I see my time is up. I would like to just.
You can conclude if you have some concluding remarks.
I wanted to say that one constitutional error is enough to render a case defective, and this misadvice went to the heart of this case because it was the sole reason, the primary reason, Mr. Zanetto waived his right to a trial. So even though it is one error, it's a whopper.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will stand in recess until 10:15 a.m.
Thank you.
have to warn you guys about that. The lid on that one is not secure. I'm usually pretty good at that, my apologies. I'm giving that warning.
Our second case this morning is United States against Medina. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. The service court in this case illegally added an element to the specification when they found that the clause 3, General Article 134 clause, was improvident based on the inquiry, and then found appellant guilty of a Clause 2 offense. If the right test is applied, Clause 1 and 2 offenses are not lesser-included offenses of Clause 3 offenses, and the line of cases that says otherwise, commencing with SAP and extending on into its progeny, are simply wrong because they applied the wrong test. Now, in U.S. v. Jones, the court was concerned with the Sixth Amendment right of notice. And the jury trial guarantees that Jones codifies, in part, requires all elements must be charged, submitted to a jury, and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, Apprendi builds on that by stating the pleading requirement, which says, frankly, that the indictment must contain an allegation of every fact which is legally essential to the punishment to be inflicted, and it must, therefore, be supported by the verdict alone. Now, the service court said the Clause 3 offense was not provident. It could not stand. It was not viable. It had failed to state an offense for which the appellant could be punished, and therefore it was a nullity. Now, in the alternative, any construction of a nullity is not even a lesser included offense. It is simply a nullity in and of itself. We are building a new specification out of nothing. So, to the extent that that argument is viable, the service court did illegally increase the maximum punishment beyond that authorized by the verdict alone. But even if you don't look at the factual settings of those two cases and see that Apprendi is technically different.
What's the maximum punishment for the offense of which he was convicted under the table of maximum punishments?
The offense is total, the max was 25 years, I believe.
And what was the maximum punishment under the crime not capital had he been convicted of it?
It was the same.
Well, then how do you say the punishment was increased?
Well, the punishment was increased, Your Honor, if you look at the fact that based on the jurisdictional error, that the specification as it stood was a nullity. It did not exist. So you can't...
Well, you're saying that, you're saying 25 years is bigger than nothing.
Yes, sir. 25 is definitely bigger than nothing.
So is the argument that at point in time, once they realized that the case fell within Martinelli, the authorized term of imprisonment was zero for the offenses in Germany, and once they changed the specification, it was... How many years?
Between 25, yes, Your Honor. And that is specifically just for the offenses that did occur within Germany.
Counsel, what's the significance, if any, that Apprendi was a contested case and this was a guilty plea where the government wasn't under any obligation to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, Apprendi did have a plea agreement in the case. And while, as I said before, Your Honor, the factual settings of the two cases are different, the analysis was concerned largely with the constitutionality of the concerns that were voiced, mainly having to do with notice. And it does bear saying that in Apprendi, appellant was not asserting a constitutional claim based on an omission from an indictment or a grand jury. So we're not asserting the same protections that are available in certain cases, like grand jury, are necessarily transferable to the military court. But we're looking at the analysis that began with Jones that foreshadowed into Apprendi, could also be looked at to foreshadow where this court can go with this case at hand.
Is this a sentence enhancer?
Is what a sentence enhancer?
Does this case involve a sentence enhancer?
Like this case does not involve a sentence enhancer, Your Honor.
Following up on Judge Erdman's question, you do have a guilty plea here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did not the military judge apprise the accused of the fact that he was going on the second prong of 134? Did not he elicit from the accused facts and admissions that his conduct constituted and service discrediting conduct under 134?
He did talk about service discrediting conduct.
Well, it seems to me he did more than that. He elicited from the accused an admission that the specific conduct constituted service discrediting conduct under 134.
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
What's the answer to the first part of the question? Because it was a compound question.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the first part of the question, Your Honor?
Did he judge elicit a plea to 134-2?
No, he did not, Your Honor. The plea that was taken, that was accepted, was based on Clause 3, offenses not capital. The appellant pled guilty to the elements that were listed. Now, there was an additional inquiry during the province inquiry. They did discuss the idea of service discrediting conduct and whether or not appellant thought that his conduct was, in fact, service discrediting. And I think they even hit on prejudicial duty order and discipline. But that was not an element of the offense to which appellant pled guilty to.
But nonetheless, he was advised of it, placed on notice of it, and agreed that his conduct violated it.
It was an admission, Your Honor, but the idea that the first notice that appellant received that he could potentially be vulnerable under Clause 2 as opposed to Clause 3 was therefore at the province of inquiry itself.
And was there any objection by any of the counsel or the defendant?
There was not an objection at that time.
Counsel, was he informed in the course of the province inquiry, as Mason, I thought, required that even that it was that the additional information regarding the services crediting component or the prejudicial to good order and discipline component were a separate and distinct offense, even if the Clause 3 offense failed?
He was not. There was an extensive discussion in Mason, Your Honor, about the importance of what Clause 2 versus Clause 3 meant and why the judge was asking about the Clause 2 services crediting conduct. That did not occur in this particular case. The only thing that occurred in this case was that the judge did elicit admissions from appellant that, yes, he thought that his own conduct was service discrediting. The judge did not discuss with appellant the importance of that or why he was going into that inquiry at that time.
Is this an abuse of discretion?
It could be an abuse of discretion if you are looking into whether or not the providency inquiry is sufficient. But however, if
isn't that what you're talking about? Whether the plea is provident?
Well, it is whether the plea is provident, but it is a de novo review if you're looking at whether or not Clause 2 is a lesser included offense of Clause 3.
Well, I mean, do we have to look at it as lesser included offenses, or are they alternate theories of liability, or does it even make a difference?
Well, it makes a huge difference, Your Honor. Under Article 79 permits punishment of an accused for an offense necessarily included in the offense, and that comes directly from Rule 31C. There are two tests. I'm sorry.
Do you have to prove, let's take that test, do you have to prove that an accused conduct is prejudicial to good order, discipline, or services crediting in order for the government to make out a Clause 3 offense?
You do not have to prove that under Clause 3, no, Your Honor. Now, there are two separate tests that are potentially available. Now, Schmuck talked about the inherently related test. And, in fact, Schmuck said the inherently related test, which basically says that when a fact is alleged in an indictment and proved at trial, and it supports the inference that the defendant committed less serious offenses and that they are still inherently related, that was thrown out by Schmuck. The elements test was adopted by Schmuck as the appropriate way to decide whether or not one offense is in fact a lesser included offense of another offense. And it basically says that the elements of a lesser included offense are a subset of the greater offense charged, meaning that they are always present within that larger umbrella of the greater offense. Now, in the elements offense, as it is stated in Foster, which was this court's adoption of Schmuck as an applicable rule to military justice, it did in fact note that the reason the elements test is the appropriate test is because it speaks distinctly to Article 79, and the focus is on the statutory elements of the offenses as opposed to the conduct proved at trial. So we would posit, Your Honor, that the elements test is the appropriate test, and therefore those court cases that, starting with SAP, that tend to talk about the relationship and how close they are, and that maybe appellant might have been on notice because they were so close, is not an appropriate analysis for this type of question.
Counsel, I read your brief, and correct me if I misinterpreted it. You're dealing with SAP, and the brief was an attempt to distinguish it. Your argument today appears to be one that is that SAP was incorrectly decided and should be overruled. Is that a fair description of your position?
It is a fair description of the position, Your Honor, based on the fact that SAP relied on Bivens. Now, Bivens was a case that predated Foster and the Supreme Court's case in Schmuck. So it was before we all had agreed that the elements test was the appropriate test. So Bivens took the inherent relationship test, and then SAP, by applying Bivens, took the inherent relationship test as well. After everyone had agreed, after the Supreme Court had agreed, no, we're going to do the elements test, after this court and Foster had said, we agree, we're going to do the elements test, and we're going to assume that for cases of military justice, somehow SAP adopted Bivens instead and went on the inherent related test.
Counsel, just to nail down the point at this point, is it your position that overruling SAP is necessary for you to prevail in this case? That is, if we apply SAP, will your client lose?
If you apply SAP, yes, Your Honor, my client loses.
Okay, then from the perspective of stare decisis and this court, as well as the Supreme Court's view of the standards for overruling a precedent, could you go through that and explain how the circumstances would warrant overruling SAP at this point?
Yes, Your Honor, because there are two distinct lines of jurisprudence that have been introduced here. There's the Schmuck line of jurisprudence where the elements test was adopted. Then this court applied that to military justice through Foster. Then for whatever reason, SAP, after Foster, picked up the Bivens test and started to run with it. It is conflicting law in this particular case. We would ask if the primary purpose in this case is to get clarification that the elements test applies across the board to lesser-included offenses of all greater offenses.
I understand that, but in our case that dealt with abatement, we had very direct discussion of what it takes to overrule precedent. And although the judges came out on different perspectives on applying that test, there was no great disagreement on the test itself. I mean, does this court just overrule precedent because we think that it was incorrect?
Your Honor, I think that it was incorrect.
Is that enough to overrule precedent? Don't you have to show that it's unworkable or go through the rest of the test in terms of overruling?
To the degree that it is unworkable, Your Honor, one of the things that this court did in Foster was it applied the idea that Article 134 offenses can be lesser-included offenses or greater offenses of the enumerated offenses. Now, within that...
Can I just ask you a question?
Are you familiar, just if you don't mind, do you know the test that you, I mean, if you don't, it's fine, but do you know the different things that you look at?
I did not go through the start of the decisis analysis on this brief note.
Well, one of the factors that are sometimes looked to is a reason to overrule prior cases or subsequent developments in the law. Have there been any subsequent developments in the law since SAP that draw into question this question of treating things as lesser included offenses or elements, whether they ordinarily would have been or not? For example, has the Supreme Court given more attention to this issue of notice since Jones and Apprendi and their progeny, or is that not relevant to revisiting the SAP issue?
Well, Your Honor, it has been relevant. There's a whole line of cases now, and it does definitely lie along the line of the sentencing enhancements that are being decided outside of the realm of the jury trials. The federal sentencing guidelines with Blakely, Booker v. Washington, that whole line of cases has increased the awareness of notice as a relevant and important aspect of whether or not someone is going to be found guilty of the entire list of elements for which they can receive punishment.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court's decision in Shad versus Arizona?
I did not look at that one.
No. It's 501 U.S. 624. I'll briefly describe it for you and then ask you if it has any bearing on this case.
That's right.
Assuming that you are correct, and I'm not suggesting that you are, but assuming for purposes of argument that you are correct and that Clause 1 and Clause 2 are not lesser-included offenses of Clause 3, would you call them different theories of liability for an Article 134 offense, or what would you call them?
Well, they are separate offenses, Your Honor. SAP talks about them in terms of different theories of liability, but they are actually different offenses. If you apply the elements test to Clause 1 and 2 offenses with respect in comparison to Clause 3, you'll see there are basically two elements to Clause 1 and 2. The first one being most of the time subsumed in whatever crime it is that's being charged, in that the accused did do certain acts. It's that second element that is going to be a problem, that the accused conduct was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces in this case. In other cases involving Clause 1, it would be that it was prejudicial to the good order and discipline of the armed forces. So the second element is not necessarily included in all of the offenses for which a soldier may be charged. Therefore, it is that additional element which makes it not a lesser included offense of the Clause 3 offenses of General Article 133.
So you reject the proposition that's been asserted that all the enumerated offenses are themselves pregnant with service discrediting or conduct unbecoming, conduct the prejudice of good order to discipline, that they are inherently one or the other.
I do not reject it. In fact, it is a characteristic of all the offenses that are enumerated.
But we have not required that be set out as a separate element.
Yes, they are not required to prove it. However, in Foster, when this court talked about Article 134 offenses being a lesser general article offense arising out of an enumerated offense, this court stated that the government must, however, prove the additional element present in the Article 134 offense beyond a reasonable doubt, as it must any other required element of proof.
Well, how would that affect a guilty plea, where they're not required to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt, and the defendant has admitted the conduct to the judge?
If the judge did the right thing and amended the specification and amended findings during the guilty plea to reflect an adequate Clause 2 provency inquiry, it would not affect it at all. And that could have been done during this provency inquiry, but it was not. This was action taken by the service court after the provency inquiry was closed.
What should the military judge have done in the provency inquiry that he did not do?
I think the first thing that would have been that the judge needed to discuss the relevance of why it is that he was talking about a service discrediting nature of the conduct. Once that had been alleged and the appellant had said, yes, I understand the nature of my conduct was service discrediting, I agree, and provides facts to support that, then if the judge had said, well, this is an additional element, or we're going to amend the specification on the charge sheet, and if it is a guilty plea, everyone adequately weighs and says, yes, that's fine with us, we want this to happen this way, we want this provency inquiry to go well, then the judge could have amended the specification to include the service discrediting conduct as part of the specification.
So what you're saying, he didn't use the magic words, I am amending the specification?
Well, and he didn't explain to the appellant what it was that he was doing.
It seems to me that he elicited facts from the appellant and an admission that his conduct was service discrediting. What else is required?
Well, Rita, which is a recent 2007 case, talks about facts being conceded by the defendant as exceptions to the joint apprendi rule, which is what we've been discussing. Now, those facts, though, were not elements. They were other surplus facts. To the extent that if appellant is found guilty of Clause 2 offense instead of Clause 3, and there's that additional element of Clause 2 not present in Clause 3, then additional facts that are evinced during the provency inquiry should not be able to save the specification.
Go ahead.
Isn't a smaller argument that you could make that under Mason, if he was going to, that when he talked about the additional element, that he needed to explain to the accused that that was a distinct and separate theory of liability, right? And that he didn't do that, and what the accused pled guilty to was a Clause 3 offense, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that what the appellate court did was get rid of the Clause 3 offense and prove a theory of liability that the accused did not plead guilty to.
Yes, Your Honor, that is a much more succinct way to approach this line of cases should this court choose to do so. If we want to have a knowing waiver during the provency inquiry and the judge does explain, I'm explaining the service discrediting nature, this is the reason I'm doing it, is that okay with you? Are you also pleading guilty to potentially a Clause 2 offense? And everyone agrees on the record that that is in fact a good waiver.
Counsel, how can you rely now on that language and the argument from Mason when Mason, in fact, relied on SAP, and you're asking us to overrule SAP and its progeny, one of which is Mason?
Yes, the main analysis of Mason does rely on SAP. But looking at Mason for anything that we could glean from it, the idea that
I mean, how much can we rely on it? Either we overrule it and it's gone, or is this section good, this one little section over here?
I think the dicta of how the judge attempted to handle this is an appropriate guideline. I do not think that it is a holding that would, unless this court chooses to make it so, with ruling on this case, it is not binding. And because Mason does fall in the line of SAP's progeny, to the degree that it uses the inherently related test as opposed to the elements test, it is not good.
So you're not arguing it as authority. You're arguing it as this is something that should have been.
Yes, Your Honor. But when you look at the potential ways to fix this situation, one is to lay out guidelines for the military judge. How do you get an appropriate waiver when a Clause 3 offense is involved, and you think that there might be a Clause 1 or 2 offense? How do you cover yourself appropriately and save the guilty plea? So there's what the judge could do. Then there's also a couple different ideas that the court could put forth in how to save the charge itself. In Foster, this court had laid out the idea that if you just plead in the alternative, if you're looking at 144 offenses and enumerated offenses, then you're appropriately covered. The same concept would work here. If they pled in the alternative with a Clause 2 offense on the charge sheet as well, then it would have been saved. And the third idea would be that if the service discrediting conduct had been explicitly asserted in the language of the specification itself, and thereby one of the elements to which appellant was pleading during the province of inquiry, that also would have saved the specification. But none of those things were done. As a result, the specification that was eventually constructed by the service court illegally added an element to what appellant initially pled guilty to.
Counsel, in that regard, what's your view of the impact of Nieder against the United States, the Supreme Court's decision regarding harmless error when an element is omitted and the facts aren't contested? Let's say we agree with you that SAP should be overruled. In a guilty plea case, why does that necessarily lead to an overturning of the plea when the facts are not contested as to an element?
But it has to do, Your Honor, with the sanctity of the guilty plea itself and whether or not the verdict alone supports the finding of guilt. And when a service court or another authority can come in after the fact and insert elements or insert situations or aspects of the crime that were not knowingly pled to during the providency inquiry, then that becomes a notice issue of constitutional proportions. So it is not a harmless error. His admissions did not go to his plea. Whatever he said when he said, "I pled guilty," it was not pleading guilty to a Clause 2 offense. So any surplus language, even the admissions, should not be used to save this specification and construct an entirely new one. SAP was wrong because they relied on an inherently related test. We would ask that you would clarify this area of law and unify it into one body, thereby overruling the service court's action of bringing forward a Clause 2 offense where they found improvident a Clause 3 offense, and send this case back to the service court, or the trial court, excuse me, for a sentence rehearing.
Could you please think about this one point and get back on rebuttal, please, which is what about the discussion under Article 134 that talks about the fact that you don't need to plead Clause 1 or Clause 2. As I read it, you could not plead them at all. Do you know what I'm talking about?
That's paragraph 60C6A in Part 4 of the manual. If you could respond to that on rebuttal.
Yeah,
I will respond on rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel Pugliese.
My name is Captain Adam Kazin, Isla, Major Elizabeth Murata, representing the United States in this matter. The Army Corps did not run afoul of the Supreme Court's rulings in Jones v. United States, Apprendi v. New Jersey, or Schmuck v. United States. The Army Corps properly followed this court's jurisprudence when it affirmed the appellant's convictions for violations of Clause 2 of Article 134 as lesser included offenses. Now, in this specified issue, the court identified three cases that might impact this court's decision, as well as the line of cases starting with SAP and extending all the way to Martinelli, Reeves, and Hayes. The first one being Schmuck v. United States, which is the case that gives us the elements test. Now, this case was first, as counsel pointed out, in two cases, first in Tudor and later on in Foster, the court utilized the elements test and applying it to the military. And in Foster, the court addressed several of the same issues and questions that are being presented before this court today. In that case, it wasn't just a matter of applying the elements test, it was a matter of deciding can Article 134 be a lesser, a Clause 102 offense, ever be a lesser included offense of a enumerated article, because by its very nature, Clauses 102 add an element. And the court in Foster discussed this idea that a strict or overly strict interpretation of the elements test would create unique results, in that an Article 134 offense under Clause 102, a search warrant could potentially, under a multiplicity analysis, face convictions for two separate offenses for one particular act, because under a strict application elements test, 134 has this two extra element, as they were calling it. It doesn't survive a multiplicity analysis, and they said that doesn't make any sense. The other issue that the court addressed was that at this point, the appellant would, the accused would be denied the opportunity to have lesser included defenses presented to the panel. Foster specifically dealt with a charge of sodomy, and whether indecent assault or indecent acts were lesser included of those. And the court, in the end, the court determined that indecent acts could be a lesser included offense of sodomy, even though there is a prejudicial delay in discipline service spreading in point there.
Are you asking us to consider Clause 3 as an enumerated offense?
I think the court in applying in SAP and Augustine, there actually is one point in SAP where the court footnotes to Foster. And I think the court, by extension, has extended that logic, saying that a Clause 3 offense necessarily includes the Clause 1 and 2 points, just as an enumerated offense does. And there's a certain logic to that. There's still an extra element by a strict application of the elements test, and it would make any more sense to have an extra element for the enumerated offenses than it would for a non-enumerated offense by Congress under Clause 3.
Counsel, I apologize for interrupting you when I've just begun your argument, but I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding this sort of ephemeral element of prejudicial to good order or discipline or service discrediting that appears to float in and out of the UCMJ or in and out of charge sheets when and if it's needed only. It's either an element or it's not an element, and if it's an element, it's something that the government has to prove in every single case. And we've certainly held that you do not have to prove those elements for the enumerated offenses, and that you do not have to prove those elements for a Clause 3 offense. So what exactly are those things, and how are we to treat them?
And the court throughout, SAP and Augustine Foster, has described them as, at one point,
implicit
alternative theories of liability. They've also used the term closely related offense or lesser included offense. And it's just sort of ways of essentially talking about the same thing of elements that are necessarily included. There is a line in Foster that might address this question, Your Honor. It's at page 147 of Foster, and it was when this issue of notice was brought up, and if I may quote it. Finally, the appellant contends that he was not fairly put on notice that he could be convicted of this particular lesser-included offense. Article 79 put him on notice, however. Moreover, because all the elements of committing indecent acts are expressively or impliably included within sodomy and indecent assault, he had notice, incentive, and opportunity to present defenses to those elements. So the court addressed those elements on the idea that the elements can also be impliably included as opposed to one-for-one. And that would apply to attempts as well, Your Honor. If we think about Article 79, it doesn't just talk about lesser included offenses, but it specifically makes reference to attempts. And if we would apply this logic to its final conclusion, attempts could never be a lesser included offense of the greater offense, because attempts always add a new specific intent element. If a person is charged with rape, the government only needs to prove that there was sexual intercourse and it was by force and without consent under the old rape statute. However, if we throw in that if a person was being convicted of attempted rape, there's a new specific intent element that applies to every attempt case that is now wasn't there before but is now suddenly existing there. So again, it's the same idea that there can be elements that are impliedly part of the statute. And what the court said in Foster, and what I think was extended through Sapp, Augustine, and that line of cases, was that the because it's all coming flowing from Article 134, the Clause 1 and 2 offenses are impliedly under the Clause 3 offense. And here this also makes sense. This way a person can't be charged with both the federal statute being brought in through Clause 3, and then also be charged with a Clause 1 or 2 offense for the same conduct. And certainly, under the elements test, there's no multiplicity issue there. That would be multiplicious because it's because one is a lesser included offense of another.
But for a charge of attempt or for a lesser included offense of attempt, they would have to prove the mens rea, right? That they would have to prove the extra element, wouldn't they?
And in this case,
and
the government...
And for rape or for Clause 3 of Article 134, the government doesn't have to prove prejudicial to good order, discipline, or service discrediting, does it?
No, Your Honor, it does not. But actually, I have to back up a little bit. For a charge of rape, the government does not have to prove the specific intent of it, because attempts require that there be an intent to violate the law. The government does not prove that for an underlying offense, but it does have to prove that for attempt.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, is if your example was, well, there's this, you know, that it's there, that the intent, you know, it's there or it's not there, and I'm just saying that the government would have to prove that extra element in order to make out the lesser included offense there.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And in this case, in order for the government to get a Clause 1 or 2 offense affirmed at any level, under Article 59 for a subsequent authority to affirm the lesser included offense, that the facts must be established at trial to the trier of fact beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where we get into the Apprendi portion of it. Now, in our brief, we talked about that Apprendi is not having a direct application in this case, and it doesn't, in the sense that there is no dispute here that the fact of service discrediting conduct was established at trial beyond a reasonable doubt by virtue of the guilty plea.
Was he aware that he was pleading guilty to 134.2?
Specifically to 2, there was no discussion of the difference distinction between a Clause 2 and a Clause 3 offense, Your Honor. However, when he, at page 102 and page 115 of the record of trial, the military judge, when listing the elements, specifically included service discrediting conduct and prejudicial order and discipline. And at pages 115 and 116 and 122 and 123, the fact of whether or not it was service discrediting conduct was discussed as an element. And this is in accordance with this court's...
So it's your position, it's your view that he was fully aware that he was admitting to an element of discredit, but it's also your position that he was not aware that he was pleading guilty to 134.2.
He was no more aware that he was pleading to a lesser included offense than any person when they pleaded.
You're moving on to the next round of questions.
Yes, Your
Honor. I'm just asking the government's view of how you read the record. I know your argument.
He was specifically placed on notice as per Article 79 of that it was being addressed to him as an element, not just some random fact that they were talking about.
And if it were not a lesser included offense under CARE, would he need to be aware that he's pleading guilty to 134.2?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, say again?
Let's say if it were not a lesser included offense, 134.2, under CARE, would the appellant have needed to know that he was actually pleading to 134.2 as opposed to 134.3?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that...
So you can plead guilty to offenses when you're not even told what the offense is. You just plead to different things and someone sorts it out later and decides what you're guilty of.
No, certainly, because this goes to the Article 59 power of what a later court can actually affirm, and he can only plead guilty to those charges that are either right before him or the lesser included offenses. You are essentially...
Right, so I gave you a without prejudice to your argument, I presented the notion that if it were not an LIO, under care, would he need to know he was pleading guilty to 134.2 as opposed to 134.3?
I think so, Your Honor, and I'm answering your question a little on the fly here, in that it would sort of be like if a person was being charged with a larceny, there's multiple theories of liability under larceny. There's conspiracy theory, there's aiding and abetting, and then there's directly stealing something. And the question that would become is whether or not, if he was pled guilty under one theory, whether or not the care inquiry was sufficient to establish the other theories as well. And that would be sort of a factual question. If a person was charged with larceny and the only discussion at the care inquiry was directly stealing it, and there was never any discussion of possible liability or conspiracy theory, that would be an issue of whether or not there was sufficient facts established to support the guilty plea. But in this case, the military judge discussed all the elements of the statute, specifically discussing service discredit and conduct. So if there are truly alternate theories of liability, as this court laid out in SAP, then both theories of liability have been established in the sense that they went to each element of the specific statute at hand, which was later, the extraterritoriality issue came through. But then he also discussed that alternative theory of liability of service discredit and conduct, which established beyond a reasonable doubt at the trial level. And again, that is what addresses the Apprendi issues. Apprendi is primarily concerned with facts suddenly being brought in on sentencing that were enhancing the maximum statutory punishment. And the underlying finding or holding of Apprendi, which is, other than the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt, is not an issue here, because again, the facts are established beyond a reasonable doubt prior to sentencing, and there is no increase in the statutory maximum penalty. That it does go a little bit towards Appellant's argument earlier that it's always increased, the statutory maximum is always increased every time a charge is essentially thrown out because it goes back to zero. But in that case, then Article 59 would become useless because the court could never have thrown the lesser included.
I think that you're dismissing Appellant's argument a little bit too lightly, as I don't think that she said it always goes back to zero. I think that she said that in this particular case, because of the effect of Martinelli, that legally, as a matter of law, with respect to the charged offense and the acts in Germany, that at that moment in time, based on the specification, he was not entitled to be punished. There was no entitlement to punishment for that particular behavior. And so when they amended the specification and changed it so that it became a valid specification under Clause 2, that then they were entitled to punishment. I don't think that you should dismiss that argument as lightly as you appear to be doing.
Well, it goes back to the issue, and that's good with factual scenario and Foster to a certain degree. I mean, they said that it was legally and factually not sufficient for conviction of Foster. So technically, they're not entitled to any punishment under that particular statute as well. However, because of the lesser included offense, the lower court and this court do not have a problem of affirming a conviction for indecent acts. It's the same idea of what creates a nullity when a charge is essentially dismissed at appellate level, but a lesser included offense is found.
Now, I don't have Foster with me, but as I recall, Foster was a contested case, wasn't it?
It was a contested case, yes,
and in that case, isn't what they were looking at was whether or not the jury's decision to amend the specification based on the facts that they had found was allowable.
Well, there was two levels to it, Your Honor. The jury actually found Foster guilty. He was charged with sodomy. He was found guilty of indecent assault, and it was affirmed indecent acts. So we actually had three different statutes going there. And so the question is if the indecent assault is out, in that case, if the indecent assault is out, then how do you have indecent acts? It's the same sort of logic. I don't think that increases the statutory maximum penalty, which was the concern. And I mean, whether or not it creates a nullity doesn't really affect the statutory maximum penalty. And again, if we look at Apprendi and look at Jones and what the governments in those cases were trying to do was say, okay, you pled, and Apprendi actually was a guilty plea where they pled guilty to the underlying offense. And in sentencing, this this racial bias issue came up, and it was going to increase the statutory maximum penalty. And suddenly he's at a disadvantage because he pled guilty to one thing, not realizing that there was going to be a new statutory maximum. That's not the issue here. The issue here is, to notice extent, is a person on notice of their lesser included offenses? And this court has said, yes, Article 79 puts you on notice. SAT was established law. The idea that a Clause 1 and 2 offense could be a lesser included of Clause 3 was established.
Here's a question, right? And I don't know if Apprendi answers this or if it doesn't answer this or whether this court's jurisprudence answers it or not, but would you agree that Article 134 is the general article, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't really tell you that much, is that correct?
No, it does not.
Right, and so you have to rely on that and the specification to give you notice of what it is that the government's theory is that they're proceeding on, right?
Not necessarily. I don't know if Article 134 is completely unique in that respect, Your Honor. As I said, there are times where a person may be charged with a numerated offense, and the language of the statute itself is not going to reveal what the government's theory is going to be.
Okay, so let's take larceny, right? If you just said, you know, did steal, and they used that specific article, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You'd agree that the government could then go forward at trial and proceed on any theory that's permissible under the larceny statute as a theory of larceny, couldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And that would actually involve, I mean, what you would call facts that are going to establish criminal liability. I mean, if you're going to allege larceny and you're going to rely on a conspiracy theory, you're going to have to prove certain facts. But those facts aren't pled and they aren't aren't considered strictly elements.
Right. Well, let's change it a little bit so that the specification now has very specific facts or a very specific theory of liability.
Yes, Your Honor.
To larceny, and the person pleads guilty to a specific theory of larceny.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then after that fact, we say, oh, that theory of larceny is constitutionally invalid. Okay? Based on that, can the lower court then go and find some other theory of larceny and affirm it on that basis and write a new specification?
Only if it was those facts were established at the guilty plea inquiry beyond a reasonable doubt. An example, I'll give you, let's say the court suddenly found that conspiracy theory could not create liability under larceny. But there was a discussion about aiding and abetting liability, and the aiding and abetting liability is perfectly fine, and it was discussed, and it was listed as an element, just as it was in this case, and it was admitted to beyond a reasonable doubt. It certainly doesn't run afoul of Apprendi or the elements test, as it's been applied to the military through Foster.
Do you think that the Supreme Court's opinion in Chiarella agrees with what you've just said?
I'm sorry?
The Chiarella opinion?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that. That did not come up in my research. Against the idea that there's unique powers here because in the federal court system, at least I'm not aware of it, that the appellate courts can simply affirm lesser included offenses the way our service courts and this court can do in the military. So there's a little bit of a disconnect because it's not part of their analysis. Apprendi and Jones, Apprendi and Jones, the analysis was focused on, lesser included offenses at all. It was never really discussed at all. And so that's, again, bootstrapping the Apprendi analysis to lesser included offenses is going to require a larger leap. Not to focus on too much of time, but I do want to address a question you brought up about Mason, whether or not the inquiry was sufficient. And there's, I don't think I made this point clear in my brief, but this court said in both Martinelli and in Reeves that there is a distinction between the O'Connor and Mason line of cases in this court's inquiry versus the Augustine Sapp inquiry. And if I may quote, it says, the difference between our review of the province inquiry under the O'Connor-Mason standard and our review under the less strict Augustine Sapp standard is a qualitative difference. Although the understanding required of a service member remains the same, we require a clear, more precise articulation of the service member's understanding under O'Connor than we require in cases where the accused's First Amendment rights are not implicated. There is a distinction between this case and between Mason and O'Connor. In Mason and O'Connor, the issue was the First Amendment and the virtual pornography portions of it, where in those cases the service discrediting conduct was going to be used to affect a First Amendment right that the Supreme Court had found in Ashcroft's Free Speech Coalition. And this court said that it was going to have require a little more searching review of that when that providence inquiry is going to affect this First Amendment right. So in this case, this is not a case where the First Amendment right was implicated by the service discrediting conduct, and So therefore, it's more on the Augustine Sack analysis than it is under the O'Connor Mason analysis. And looking at the Augustine Sack analysis, again, the military judge went through each offense, discussing service discrediting conduct at least 7 times. And there were 7 specifications of under Article 134. The first, the definition was first given at page 25. It was discussed each time with respect to specifications 4 to 7, and then specifications 1, 2, and 3, even over the last, and each time he listed it as an element, and each time he obtained a clear and unequivocal answer that the credit was service discrediting from the appellant. So it is established beyond a reasonable doubt, making it, because it's a lesser included offense, making clause 1 and 2 available to the appellate courts should the clause 3 offense for some reason not survive, as it did when it might not.
Counsel, the counsel for appellant has offered a somewhat different argument today than in the appellant's brief, and that is now there's a recommendation to overrule SAP. If you haven't prepared this, that's fine, but I was wondering if you might address the conditions under which Stare Decisis should not be followed and we should overrule precedent. What's the government's argument on that in this case?
And I've dealt with that in case. I can't remember the exact case for the test. It is a heavy burden. I do recall that from the government at times trying to get this court to overrule precedent. But it is a heavy burden when they're asking for a court to overrule precedent. And it often does require, I think as Judge Brown noted in one of your questions, some sort of subsequent case that would affect the prior precedent. I would address there are 2 points to the Stare Decisis. One is that the idea that SAP does not is sort of an alternative line of cases. We look at the government's position is that there's a line, a direct line from Schmuck versus the United States to Foster through SAP, Augustine, all the way up to Mount Mellon and Reeves, and there is an unbroken line there. That footnote in Foster being really the best evidence of that lineage, and that. SAP is not exclusively relying on Bivens, and SAP is not relying on the inherent relationship test, but it is consistent with this court's precedent in Foster as well. The second point is that the idea, again, Apprendi and Jones do not change the calculus. That evidence would be, if someone were to point to the new precedent that might change the court's analysis from SAP, I think SAP actually came either way out or right around Apprendi, and then later on, Mason and O'Connor were post-Apprendi cases. But Apprendi doesn't change the calculus because, again, Apprendi did not address the elements test. Apprendi did not address lesser-included offenses. So Apprendi would not be an appropriate source to say that we need to overrule the precedent from 1994 and Foster all the way up to Reeves and Hayes.
Well, we're not dealing, my recollection of tests is we're not necessarily dealing with cases from another court or the Supreme Court that directly apply. If that were the case, it would be easy. We'd be bound to overrule. But rather that there are developments in the law that undermine the theory of the case. So the question is, the Supreme Court's focus on the role of the fact finder in dealing with those matters of which a person is going to be found guilty. Why is that not a development that we should take into account? After all, you know, Apprendi, Blakely, these are all cases which 10 years ago were not even on the horizon. Now we have those developments.
Yes, sir. And I don't think, and the government says those developments don't impact the line of precedent that we're talking about. There's certainly no way, and they may impact other areas of military justice, but they don't impact this one. And the government has no essential quarrel with the underlying rulings or reasonings of the Supreme Court or the developments that facts that are going to increase the statutory maximum penalty are going to have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the panel. And that's done in these cases. I'll go back to Larson again, it's an example we keep going back to, but if there's several different maximum penalties under Larson, depending on particular facts. If a person is going to be sentenced for larceny of military property must be presented to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt in order for the government to get the benefit of that statutory maximum. And that's, as far as I know, the practice in the military justice system, maybe before Apprendi, and it's consistent with Apprendi. And so as Apprendi would apply there, that's
Let's take that then, assuming if we don't overrule SAP, and nonetheless have to apply it in light of the Supreme Court decisions. So you have larceny of military property, and in the course of proving the case, the government is unable to approve that it's military property, nor are they able to meet the each element of larceny. But they do bring out that the situation that took place with the military property was very adverse to good order and discipline in that unit. There's no notice at all, but this is evidence that's put into trial at that point. Can the Court of Criminal Appeals find somebody guilty of a disorder at that point based upon a charge that was not made, instructions that were not given at trial, or a matter in which the person during the plea inquiry was not brought to his or her attention that this is something you can be found guilty of? For example, in the course of the plea inquiry, the person said, yeah, I'm really sorry that all this happened. It really messed up our unit. It was terrible for the way we were operating, but just can't bring themselves to plead guilty to larceny of military property.
And just to be clear, is your question regarding a contested case or a non-contested case?
Well, first contested and then non-contested, in which the person, either in a contested case, it's proven there's evidence upon which members could find that it had an adverse impact on good order and discipline, but that was not the charge. The charge was larceny of military property, and the property was mishandled. It was military property, but the larceny itself could not be proved. Or the second one would be the guilty plea, similar situation, but at no point would the judge have brought to the individual's attention that was a charge upon which they could be convicted.
Well, there are going to be additional issues there, particularly with what was the panel instructed on, what was presented to the panel, and in that case, what is proven beyond a reasonable doubt at trial is established differently, because if it was never presented to the panel, they were never instructed on it, they have no idea what the definition of service is creating, then there's going to be an issue about whether or not that fact was established beyond a reasonable doubt at trial.
How about if it's out of the accused's mouth? In the course of him defending himself or herself, says about how sorry he or she is that this happened, but it wasn't larceny and it wasn't military property, either one. But in the course of that, they acknowledge what a terrible effect that person's handling of the property had on the unit.
Well, again, the question is whether or not, does that statement equate to meeting the definition of services greater than conduct simply by itself? Again, whether or not he admits it was services greater than conduct in the context of a contested case, or admits to something that might be considered services greater than conduct, is different. If he actually haven't said, my conduct was services greater than, we have a different issue there because he's admitted something, and that might establish it beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not sure in that case, I haven't worked out that factual scenario through as to whether or not the service courts really have the authority, because the question is whether or not that fact was actually established at trial. A guilty plea is going to be a little bit different in the sense that when the appellant admits something or don't say something or admits to an element, it is, as Mr. Erman mentioned, establishing it beyond a reasonable doubt because it's relieving the government of that burden.
Here you've argued in this case that it was brought to his attention, we'll have to look at the record and decide for ourselves, that it was brought to his attention that it was an element.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the same apply where that's not brought to the individual's attention? That is, it's not a charge. It's not brought to the individual's attention that they're an element. They, in the course of the plea colloquy, say words that amount to service discrediting or prejudicial and good order and discipline. Can you go ahead and find somebody guilty at that point when it's never been brought to their attention that it's either an offense or that it's an element?
Under the court's current precedent, I don't think that is possible, only because Foster, that he government this needs to be established. Also through SAP, Augustine, Mason, and O'Connor, I think the court stated it, and I'm quoting Martinelli here at 67, is the critical inquiry here is whether the record reflects an appropriate discussion of and focus on the character of the conduct at issue as service discrediting or prejudicial legal discipline. So the court has established a standard there for determining. Now, they also bifurcated that standard between O'Connor, Mason cases and Sackler, Augustin cases. But again, if it's established beyond reasonable doubt and that standard is met as far as putting them on notice, then there is no issue.
Can particular conduct be an offense under prong 1 and not under 2, or vice versa, leave 3 out of it?
can the services credited and not prejudicial be admissible?
Yes.
In my imagination, I can't imagine, Your Honor. I'm not sure as a legal standard whether or not one can't or cannot be a lesser included offense of the other. I think the language in the case law says under certain circumstances, one may be a lesser included offense or another. I mean, I guess it's all...
Well, I didn't really ask whether one was a lesser included offense or the other. I asked whether the two can be mutually exclusive.
I think they can, Your Honor. I think it's possible for some of these services credit or not.
You just quoted from Martinelli, and you didn't move on to the next sentence.
The next sentence, Your Honor, talks about... It's going towards that when I was talking about the Mason O'Connor standard.
The record must conspicuously reflect that the accused clearly understood the nature of the prohibited conduct as being a violation of Clause 1 and Clause 2, Article 134, apart from how it may or may not have met the elements of the separate criminal statute underlying Clause 3. So what in this record indicates that this accused or appellant understood the nature of the prohibited conduct as being a violation of Clause 1 and Clause 2. Is Clause 1 or Clause 2 mentioned during the care inquiry?
Not specifically, Your Honor. However, if I may, that second part of that quote from Martinelli is going towards what the court said in Reeves and Hayes, is that qualitative difference between a Mason-O'Connor inquiry and a Augustine Sapp inquiry. And Martinelli had two things. One of the Martinelli specifications was tossed, essentially, on... let me finish your question before my time has run out. One of the specifications was thrown out on Ashcroft free speech grounds. The other ones were thrown out on extraterritorial grounds. The issue was there was no discussion in Martinelli at all of any services credit in conduct. There was zero. It was never mentioned, so the court didn't really address that qualitative difference. In Reeves and Hayes, the court went on to kind of make that distinction, at least as Martinelli, to make that distinction between the more searching inquiry and really that understanding that Clause 3 offenses applied to you is going to violate your First Amendment rights. Clause 1 and 2 is now going to essentially impact that First Amendment rights. It's going to require a more searching inquiry. And that's that second sentence, Martinelli, that you just mentioned, Your Honor.
Judge Ryan, did you have a question before you wanted to for the first?
I was just going to ask counsel. I mean, I understand your position and your argument in this case, and I understand the gloss that you've given to the Apprendi line of cases. Have you considered, though, whether it's wise to try and read those cases that narrowly in the context of Article 134 and historic concerns over its apparent vagueness in this court's duty to appropriately limit it?
I think the Apprendi, based on the language of Apprendi itself, talks about that it is dealing with a narrow issue. And even though you have some sort of cases, and I'm not familiar with Shadow, I'm not familiar with Booker and Blakely, again, dealing with those issues at sentencing and sentencing enhancers and increasing statutory maximum penalties, those were its concerns. And in Apprendi, it really kind of goes to kind of historical, through the history of the sentence enhancer and how the development of it and how it's essentially taking facts away from the fact finder and giving it to the judge under a preponderance of the evidence standard. That's the other big issue, and I'm running here, but the other big issue in Apprendi and why it's now is that there is a new standard of proof being applied to these elements that wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt. They were being applied a preponderance of the evidence standard by the judge alone. And as opposed to the beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard is required for a fact to increase the statutory maximum. And the line of cases after Apprendi, some ones I'm familiar with, see, again, is more concerned with that rather with lesser included offenses. I think lesser included offenses is a really separate area of jurisprudence that is not directly or indirectly impacted specifically by the Apprendi line of cases. This court's precedent establishing the Clause 1 and 2 offenses as a lesser-included offense of Clause 3 charges is untouched by United States v. Jones or Apprendi v. New Jersey. Appellant unequivocally admitted during the Providence inquiry that coercing his daughter into making pornographic pictures and then distributing those pictures through the Internet was service-discrediting conduct, establishing it as a fact beyond a reasonable doubt. As such, the Army Corps properly found that appellant was provident to violations of Article 134 under Clause 2. This court should affirm the Army Corps' decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Stefan, I wanted to address the concern that you had with Article 134 and whether or not the larceny specification that would not stand could be resurrected under a Clause 1 or Clause 2 Article 134 offense. There would be two concerns with that, Your Honor. First being the lesser included offense and the nature of that type of offense would not give the person notice. But specifically under the language in the UCMJ in the manual that talks about Article 134, it does state that Article 134 cannot be used to create a new kind of larceny offense, one without the required intent, where Congress has already set the minimum requirements, for such an offense in Article 121. So that directly relates to the idea that the elements of a charged offense where someone knows that they're being charged under Article 120. The lesser-included offenses of Article 120 are clearly laid out, and everyone knows what they are. And so being charged with 120 gives that person notice that they are likewise potentially being charged with lesser-included offenses that are available under that charge. That is not true in Article 134. Also, with respect to your concerns about stare decisis, Your Honor, SAP was found in contravention of existing U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Foster was indeed on the ground. Schmuck was on the ground at the time that SAP was decided. So you don't even need to get into that stare decisis analysis if you look at cleaning up this kind of muddied waters that SAP introduces into this analysis. The idea that elements can be impliedly included flies directly in the face of the pleading requirement that is laid out in Apprendi. And I would agree and put forth that Apprendi is not so narrowly constructed as to only be applicable when we're dealing with sentence enhancements. There's a constitutional analysis of care with regard to notice and due process issues that are directly related to whether or not Clause 1 and 2 offenses can be lesser included offenses of Clause 3. The idea that someone who is charged under 134 Clause 3 offenses are as aware of lesser included offenses as anybody else, that goes straight to notice. Everybody else does have it clearly laid out. But the lesser-included offenses, they're explicit, they're laid out within the manual. At this point, we don't have that same opportunity to deal with it in Article 134.
What about the paragraph that Judge Urban and I asked you to look at?
Yes,
with respect to the fact that I believe that, at least looking at the manual, it says that a specification would be valid if it didn't say anything about it being service discrediting or prejudicial to good order and discipline, that it could still make out a valid Clause 1 or Clause 2 offense.
It does say that. That is 6 sub A that you are quoting from. Need not expressly allege that their conduct was a disorder or neglect, that it was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces, or that it constituted a crime or offense not capital. However, this is just the manual. It is not statute. And that directly contravenes the idea of the elements test, that things need to be explicit. It also brings into doubt the idea of why we have 3 clauses at all. Why have 3 clauses if 1 clause would work? If there's no difference, if there's not an extra element in 1 and 2, then why do they exist? In Article 134, C sub 3, it lays out the conduct that is likely to be brought under Clause 2. The language says this clause of Article 134 makes punishable conduct which has a tendency to bring the service into disrepute or which tends to lower it in public esteem. Acts in violation of a local civil law or a foreign law may be punished if they are of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. The MCM, UCMJ, explicitly notes the idea that not all conduct will bring discredit upon the armed forces. There's a delineation between the clauses that make them different from one another. They are not all one umbrella offense.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the government.
Yes, sir.
Can you have a prong one offense that's not a prong two, or vice versa? Leave 3 out of it.
without more explicit direction as to what is defined as prejudicial to good order and discipline and where the dividing line between that and service discrediting conduct, I think that would be difficult to answer. Things like tax evasion, probable service discrediting, whether or not it's...
Well, good order and discipline seems to go to the internal operations of the armed forces. Service discrediting seems to go to the public image of the armed forces.
Yes,
you know, you kick a public horse in the belly, which is it?
Yes, Your Honor, but there is some kind of distinction, and it's not just a matter of we all wear the green suit, so any type of conduct that we may have could potentially...
What you're saying is it's more than an oblong border.
Yes, it has to be direct. It has to be concrete, something that you can put your hands on. It can't just be you're a soldier, so anytime you look cross-eyed at someone, that's service discrediting. This element was added in contravention of existing case law. Now, it was probably done because SAP seems to say that that's the right way to handle this. Our service courts need clarification. SAP was decided in contravention of existing case law that existed from Schmuck and that this court upheld in Foster as applicable to the military justice system. We would ask that you would clarify CAP, the SAP line of cases, bring them back in line. Mandate that the elements test is the only test that's appropriate for determining when a lesser included offense exists under a greater offense. We'd ask that you would dismiss this specification and send this case back to the trial court for a sentence reassessment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. Case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.